I'm Jason Van Medding.
And I'm Ksenia Chmutina.
Welcome to Disasters Deconstructed podcast. So, welcome back, everyone. This week, we did something a bit different because we had a lot of international guests in town in Gainesville for the 9th International IREC Conference. So we took the opportunity to do a live recording at the first plenary session where we interviewed some really interesting disaster researchers who are sort of emerging in the field. The sound is a little bit echoey because we're in a big room, but I've done my best. Enjoy.
So welcome to Disasters Deconstructed live recording. And if you're not following us yet, please follow us on Twitter at DisastersDecon and on Instagram.
And subscribe on iTunes and Spotify.
Yeah, don't forget to subscribe. Right, so we're live recording, feel free to shout appropriate things. If you shout an ism, if you shout a jargon, or indeed if you use a jargon, you will be contributing to the jargon jar, which Jason has contributed immensely already.
Yep.
In our previous episode, so I'll just put it there. The nice reminder. Right.
Thanks for saying
that. Are we ready to play?
We are. So today we're joined by four young researchers who are part of the IREC network, and we're going to get to know them a bit. Diana Contreras from University of Newcastle in the UK, not the University of Newcastle that I was at short time ago. We have Sandika Manikar from University of Auckland, Aaron Opdyke from University of Sydney, and Thomas Johnson from University of Newcastle, Australia. So welcome to all of you. We want to know how you ended up researching in disaster studies and what it is that you research.
Thank you, Jason, for the invitation. So in 1999, an earthquake struck the western part of my country, Colombia. And in that time, the university took us twice to visit the disaster area, the city of Armenia. The first time, we went just to check the performance of the structures that were constructed in bamboo and in concrete, and then compare the results. And the second time, the idea was to design housing in a participatory way for people who have lost their houses due to the earthquake. And we visit different temporary shelters, and we talk to people what they were their needs, what they would expect about their new houses. And that's the way in which I get interested into the topic.
Hi, everyone. So for me, I guess my background is in civil and structural engineering, and I've always been really interested in like humanitarian sort of work. But I think the seed for kind of this whole journey was planted back because I happened to be on holiday in Sri Lanka when the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami struck. And I was just an undergrad, you know, just started uni, and I got into volunteering for the relief effort after the tsunami. And ever since then, I've kind of become more and more interested in how, like, what kind of role civil engineering can play in post-disaster recovery. And, you know, that kind of carried on. But when I got more into my work and my research, I realized that post-disaster recovery is a lot bigger than civil engineering. It's a lot bigger than kind of the silo that we normally work in, looking at risk reduction and built environment. And so I started sort of expanding into looking at recovery in a more holistic way. And so I got into the concept of building back better, which I've been researching since about 2010.
So I think like many people, I was in disasters, and that's kind of how I got into this space. So growing up in California, I think I was always exposed to earthquakes, so that really got me thinking about this as really as a career. But it wasn't really until I traveled, I was doing a little bit of work overseas in India. So I was actually doing a project, a sanitation program, where one of the families that we were working with was killed in a landslide. And then subsequently, I was involved in an earthquake in Sikkim. I think those experiences really taught me, I always thought about disasters as physical events, but for the first time, I think it was really brought this awareness that they are really social phenomena that occur. So that kind of drove me down the pathway that I'm in today, so working for different non-governmental organizations, and then onto my current role where I'm at now at the University of Sydney. So really my research, though, seeks to try to understand how we can improve housing and shelter assistance in humanitarian response.
So I started in the construction industry. I was working as a surveyor and as an estimator, and I was finishing my degree in construction management. But in Australia, or probably in many countries around the world, the construction industry is very cutthroat. So you feel like you're either being ripped off or you're forced to rip somebody else off just to turn a profit. In my honors year of the construction management, I took an elective in disaster management, and that really opened my eyes to just how all-encompassing it can be, how you can look at sustainable development, you can look at climate change issues, you can look at social inequality. So that really made the decision for me quite easy. I was captivated by disaster research and continued from there. So I traveled to Rakhine State in Myanmar. So I was working with an NGO there and looking at the different communities and how they differ in disaster vulnerability, and that includes the Rohingya population there. So now I look at the humanitarian sector in Bangladesh and how they can influence the vulnerability of the displaced people in the Cox's Bazar region.
We kind of know, all of us, I guess, here in the room, that disasters and crises could be a great opportunity to actually start something better, right? But very often we instead use disasters as an opportunity to kind of redevelop and thus reconstruct the already existing risks. So why do you think that is, and how can we stop this?
Yeah, it is an opportunity, and I guess we have to look at who is it an opportunity for, and often it's the wrong people that are trying to take advantage of this. So in my research, I've had the opportunity to interview a lot of people that are working in the humanitarian sector. And I get to know them quite well and ask them how they got into the sector, and a lot of people have entered the humanitarian sector with completely altruistic motives, but once they're within the system, they realize they can't really affect any change. They can't make the change that they want to see. And maybe I felt the same in the construction industry, that I wanted to make change, but couldn't really do this.
I wanted to ask you, Sandhika, about resilience. Some argue that resilience is not actually a very useful concept, and that some of the ideas to do with building back better and so on are a little bit of an illusion rather than actually dealing with the creation of risk. So how does your work respond to those critiques, and what are the key ingredients of building back better? How does it challenge the status quo?
Yeah, I do agree. Resilience is a very tricky concept, especially to quantify. I mean, there are lots of ways of measuring resilience, but it is really difficult to understand the outputs, how resilient is certain actions that we take. But I think, especially in terms of the really complex risk environment that we're in, and with climate change kind of exacerbating everything, and kind of we're getting into a lot of unknown territory, lots of different types of risks, the meaning of resilience is really important to embed into communities. And when I talk about resilience, I'm really talking about, like, the, as we all know, the ability of a community or a system to be able to take up, to cope with unexpected things, to withstand it, to recover, and then to thrive afterwards. So it's kind of a quality that we need to have, especially to be able to adapt to different types of risks. And so my view is that whatever positive changes we make will only add to resilience. So we're only kind of going in the right direction, having this in our minds is a good thing. So the premise of Building Back Better is to embed resilience into different aspects of a community. So The Build Back Better concept, I've broken it down into a three-pronged approach, that something that has to be considered simultaneously. So number one is reducing risk, and that comes from the built environment, so what structural measures can we take, as well as land use measures, as well as things like early warning and disaster risk reduction education. And all three have to be considered, and also the balance of those will really depend on the community as well. Because resilience is all about, you know, being able to actually implement things and being practical. So that's the first part that I think a lot of us are familiar with. And the second part of the Build Back Better framework or the concept is community recovery and well-being. So looking at psychological, social recovery and economic recovery. And a lot of the work I've done shows how interrelated those two are. And also the fact that reducing risk, like even if you have a really safe environment, if your people and the businesses are not doing well, you're not really creating much change, you know, positive change overall. And the final part of Building Back Better is effective implementation. So again, if you have all these amazing plans in place for your community, for your businesses, for your risk, if you can't actually put it into practice, you're not going to create any change.
All right, and well, you've just said that you need to start thinking about resilience kind of as early as possible. So, Aaron, you, you know, you've been arguing, kind of, you've been saying that your work lies, it is a nexus between engineering and kind of social inquiry. And even in your biography, I think you're saying that shelter is not just about four walls and the roof. So here's my question to you, million-dollar question. You know, what is the best solution for the shelter, and why don't we have one yet?
Yeah, so I think that's quite a difficult question to answer, but I'll take a stab at it. So I think, in general, the best solution to housing or shelter really is whatever a household decides that it is. I think at the end of the day, we continue to really privilege products in the humanitarian sector over processes, and I think that's something that we really need to work to overcome. We really have become obsessed with delivering products, and even as an engineer, I think too often we're focusing on the minute details of really trying to improve shelter and housing, when we really need to be thinking about the broader and bigger picture issues that surround it. So I think livelihoods is often one that we talk about, but we still really don't have a solid understanding of the relationship about that. So I think rather than focusing on ways that we can improve the nuts and bolts of an individual house, I think that trying to understand ways that livelihoods are contributing to housing is one step in that direction. So some of the research that we've been doing in the Philippines, for example, we've really seen that, you know, household control and oversight of construction is really key, but we need to provide those households the resources to actually take action on that. So I think to answer that question, really we need to rethink and go back to what we're actually framing and understanding housing as, and really try to provide new ways of thinking about how we can provide it to really address and provide better housing and shelter solutions.
Cool.
Great. I have a question for you, Diana. So we have a lot of debate around the indicators that are used to measure things like vulnerability, resilience, success of reconstruction, and so on. So do we need these indicators, and how do we deal with the fact that many things are immeasurable?
Okay, thank you for the question. Definitely, it's important to have this kind of debate, because in the debate is when you really need, can listen and share the arguments. And definitely, we need indicators. I mean, we define vulnerability as the susceptibility or fragility of a system or human to be harmed or damaged for an event. Could be natural phenomena or man-made. The resilience, like the capacity to anticipate, to cope, and to recover. And then we need the objective, the indicators, to be able to have an objective view and to be able to compare processes between different areas and vulnerability between different areas and recovery process. The indicators are indicators are quantitative and qualitative measures of resulting from a systematic observation of facts, yes? And then based on that is that we really can understand why some processes, why some areas are more vulnerable than others, why some recovery processes are more efficient than others, or why there are more progress in other processes than in other.
Thank you, Diana. I think all the answers, we ask difficult questions. That's what we do in our podcast. And I think these are the questions that hopefully we will be discussing throughout the conference. But I've got one more question to all of you, you know, if you could just give us your thoughts on the matter. So as a young researcher, what is the biggest challenge that you face in academia now?
Well, the biggest challenge, and it's regarding the project that I'm working, is collecting the data, the right data, yes? And the methods to collect the data, how to interpret that data, how to exploit that data. Now with the social media, we have a lot of sources, but then you have to really look carefully which is the data that really reflects a phenomenon, and there is, and how to avoid bias due to the political or other kind of conceptions.
Thank you, Dan.
I think for me the biggest challenge is like the subject of this conference, like disrupting the status quo. So no matter how much research we do, I think the real big challenge is to get it into practice. And how do we get ourselves, make ourselves heard, and how do we publish in the right places to get attention? So, yeah.
Right.
For me, I think it's picking one topic. I mean, I have a huge list of research items that I want to go through, and I feel like I could be researching that for the rest of my life, which I guess is a great problem to have. But I think on a more serious note, I think part of one of the challenges is trying to gain understanding of different fields. So I think something that's so unique about disaster studies is that it is truly interdisciplinary. And so we think that we need to have knowledge and competency across different fields. So I think we're often trained. So as an engineer, I was trained in that field. But really, as I've started to branch outside that, it's really challenged a lot of the assumptions that I've had. So I think really, though, trying to gain those competency and those skills in different fields is very time-consuming, but I think it's also quite exciting. So it's bringing new ideas into your own research.
Thank you.
I think the biggest challenge is really just trying to make sure that your research is impactful. So making sure that your research findings aren't just kind of lost in a database of academic journal articles. And that's a challenge that's not unique to young researchers. I think it's always existed, but we have an opportunity with all the modern technology that we really have a lot of mediums that we can produce our work. I think the challenge is trying to incorporate science communication into research. So I've had to change the way that I write. I've had to try and ditch all the jargon, like we have the jargon jar, and try and just write simply and clearly and try to be understood across multiple disciplines.
Great, thank you so much.
Actually, I think we have time for any questions. If the audience wants to get involved, we can pass the mic back.
Yeah,
if you
please.
Want to ask anything to these really interesting, inspiring young researchers.
If you want to feature on our podcast, yeah, please raise your hand.
And I will turn.
Yes, Thomas.
So I love the idea of disrupting the status quo, and I think it's... I'm heartened to see an increasing focus beyond just the engineering, no offense, Aaron. But I guess my question is, what we see for a lot of disasters is that we continue to increase our vulnerability, and a key element of that is where we're choosing to live and build, not just how. And I see a lot of focus on how, very little on the where. And I know the drivers are very different across different countries. Here, it's very much profit margin and property rights, whereas in a lot of developing countries, it may be unpermitted or just squatting development. How do you start to address that aspect of how we create risk and increase disasters?
Okay, I will say that principle working with the community. Sometimes we have some ideas and then we just, or in the past, the researcher just focusing the academic interest, but knowing what really people need. So the important is really to, when you select a case study area, also share your thoughts with people and create like participatory spaces in which people says what they need, what they want, and really that's the way in which you can really create an impact of your research in an area.
Yeah, and are you also talking about like changing where people live now? Yeah. That's a really, sorry, I've got a cough coming on, so if I start coughing, just like I can't. bear with me. I think, so one part of it is that it's really difficult to, especially because a lot of work that I've done, we have done a lot of work in communities where our view is that they should probably move into lower risk areas. But then I don't have a really good answer, but I'm going to tell you what the challenge is, which is that people are, you know, have been in these locations for generations. They've got cultural ties, social ties, economic ties. And even recently, I did some work in the Cook Islands looking at the resilience of businesses that keep getting pounded by these annual cyclones that are just getting stronger and stronger because of climate change. They're getting the impacts of sea level rise. But the thing is, in the Cook Islands itself, land is actually only passed on generation to generation, so it can't be sold. So you have all these other things that, you know, so it's very difficult. And in terms of climate change, I mean, we've got Bangladesh. Apparently, there's going to be 30 million climate refugees in the next couple of years. And Bangladesh itself does not have the capacity anywhere else within the inland areas to take up these refugees. So in the future, we're going to get, like, international refugee crisis because of just climate change alone. But then changing people's views, I think, can happen over time through education. If people kind of learn about risk and, you know, their perception of risk changes, that's the only way we can really make any change.
So I think the short answer to that, I think, is it's extremely political. And I think that's something that in disaster studies, admittedly, we have not done as good a job actually trying to address. In particular, I think, is trying to translate the research that we do into policy that's actionable. And I think in many ways, it's quite complex when you talk about land and place in terms of risk. But I think that that's something that we need to get better about doing, is trying to translate the research that we're doing into actionable policy that local governments can act on.
Thanks, Aaron. Yeah, Tom?
And just to expand on Bangladesh being so overpopulated and not being able to house the refugees, and now they're exploring pretty much all options, and one of them is to take up to 100,000 of the refugees and to place them on this island called Bashan Shah, which only emerged from the Bay of Bengal some decades ago, and it is quite hazardous in itself. And so it's quite extreme, the measures that we're going to try and relocate people from one risk, but then really putting them at a risk to another. And even if the claims are true and the island is completely safe to the hazards around it, is it really a viable option to just send a community completely isolated where there's no community there?
Yeah. Super, thank you so much. I think we've got time for a couple more questions, maybe.
There are four fantastic people here and many more in the room, but we're a tiny, tiny minority who are choosing to oppose what is being done. And we are trying to have an impact, but I think one of the things we need to do is move beyond talking to each other, and how do we do that is really important outcome for this conference, is how do we go beyond talking to each other?
What Ksenia and I are trying to do is to bring this kind of debate and discourse, I really appreciate your critique, Terry, for sure, to a broader audience,
right,
to kind of scale back the jargon, contribute to the jar when we need to, but open up this debate, talk to people who are actually affected rather than just to ourselves. And I think that's so important, right?
I'm sure these conversations will kind of keep appearing through the conference. Please, there's a question here.
Thank you. This question is for Sandhika, and probably for some of you, if you want to answer. But which is the role of law, of the legislation, on building back better? And also, I was thinking on shelters, for example. How do you include on the reconstruction process the housing, land, and property rights of people? How do you have a human rights approach on the reconstruction process? That's the question.
Thank you. Sandhika, do you want to start, and then I guess Sarah maybe? Thank you.
In terms of the work that I've done on Building Back Better, I look at legislation in two ways. First is legislation that's used to enforce the things that we need to enforce, and sometimes It is necessary, although I do understand that it's not practical, depending on where you are, like, for example, building codes. I've done some work in Fiji, looking at the longitudinal recovery after Cyclone Winston, and one of the first knee-jerk reactions they did over there as well is republish, or they're trying to improve the building code so that now they can design for Category 5 cyclones. But, and that's being done, and so when you talk to government, they're all about that. But when you go to the villages, they haven't even heard of the building code. So, you know, there's all these issues that we need to consider. But then there are times when it can come in handy. The other part of legislation is on facilitation. There are things that we need to simplify and fast track sometimes in rebuilding to prevent all the bottlenecks that we face.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I think in relation to shelter and housing, I think that land in particular is really the key issue that we continue to see arising around legal systems. And I think that if we think about shelter and housing, often in the aftermath of a disaster, providing secure tenure can often do more than actually providing housing assistance, more often than not. And we've seen a lot of that from the research that we've done in the Philippines, where we've actually seen that households that had land tenure, that was the deciding factor in how and why they decided to build safer. So I think that really that's challenging a lot of the assumptions that we have about how we're delivering assistance to communities that are affected by these disasters. So, but I think beyond that also really is a question about power dynamics, and I think that's a question we really need to think about. How do we address power dynamics in our legal systems that really undermine our response to disasters?
Thank you so much.
So that was Diana Contreras, Aaron Updike, Sandigan Manikara, and Thomas Johnson joining us live at IREC 2019 in Gainesville. Hopefully it was useful to listen to some of the young researchers in this field of disaster studies explain kind of what makes them tick and why they're involved in this work. Next week, we will be back with some more audio from IREC 2019. We captured so much cool stuff. It was really exciting. So we'll share more of that with you next week. For now, this is Jason von Medding signing off. Follow us on Twitter and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to the Disaster Reconstructed Podcast.